we have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard facts.
Therefore, I have determined that it is time to officially recognise Jerusalem as the capital of Israel.
United States ambassador to the UN has vetoed a draft resolution rejecting Donald Trump's decision to recognise Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. All 14 other members voted for the resolution.
Jerusalem is one of the issues that must be settled through peaceful negotiation between the Palestinians and the Israelis. Any attempt at changing facts on the ground in Jerusalem is considered an illegal unilateral measure that will have no legal impact since it goes against international law.
Defending the indefensible has long been the stock in trade of US presidents, officials, politicians, and their media apologists. But Washington's UN Ambassador Nikki Haley has taken it to a different level, to the point where it is impossible to deny any longer that she has embraced the role of professional liar with Jesuit-like zealotry. Her defence of Trump's recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital at the UN has plumbed new depths of ignobility and shame. In response to a UN resolution condemning the US president's unilateral declaration on Jerusalem, one that has left his administration isolated even among usually dependable US allies such as Britain and France, Nikki Haley had the temerity to assert, referring to the State of Israel, "To the United Nations, shame, this has been a disproportionately hostile place for the Middle East's most enduring democracy." Democracy, she says, as if apartheid, ethnic cleansing, illegal settlements, occupation, the abduction and detention of children, the murder of unarmed civilians in wheelchairs, collective punishment, embargo, imposed immiseration, and settler colonialism, as if all of that can be justified on the basis that citizens of the State of Israel designated a chosen people in comparison to the subjugated Palestinians have the right to vote into office, the leader handed the task of continuing that subjugation. This state of affairs is nothing short of monstrous, one that has given succour to Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who in Donald Trump has at last found his one true political love, a mirror image in the White House with his disregard, disrespect for, and arrogant dismissal of international law and all norms of diplomacy. With all the insouciance of a mafia boss parceling out territory to a loyal capo, in this case Netanyahu, Trump has removed all doubt when it comes to Washington's status as any kind of honest broker in resolving an issue over which a curtain of obfuscation has for far too long been allowed to confuse and beguile. This issue could not be simpler. It involves the wholesale and unremitting violation of Palestinian human rights. As for the solution, forget the long, tortuous, and unending round of destined-to-fail negotiations and peace agreements. How about instead the honest application of international law? Ibrahim Abu Thuria. His is a name that will forever represent the true nature of the Palestinian struggle for justice. Wheelchair-bound after losing both legs in an Israeli airstrike in 2008, the 29-year-old was shot dead by an Israeli soldier while participating in a protest against the recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital in Gaza. The paradox, the burning contradiction that defines the times in which we live, is that though by dint of connections, wealth and ambition, it is the Donald Trumps and Nikki Haley's of this world who wield power, it is the likes of Ibrahim Abu Thuria who represent that which gives us hope, namely courage, fidelity and dignity in defiance of might is right. I'm John White, and this is Hard Facts. Writer and author Max Blumenthal has written extensively on the issue of Israel-Palestine, and I'm delighted to say he joins me now on the line from Washington, D.C. Max, welcome to the show.
Great to be on with you, John.
Max, the strong do what they can and the weak suffer what they must. I can think of no other way to describe the state of international politics in our time. This famous quote from the Melian Dialogues by Thucydides, the Athenian general. We live in an age of might is right, don't we? Trump made this declaration only because he can.
Yeah, well, he made it because he was under enormous pressure, which he's just readily acceded to from the sort of Saudi-Israeli axis, which also works its way through the United Arab Emirates and back into the United States through a collection of oligarchs, namely three figures: Sheldon Adelson, the casino billionaire from Las Vegas and Macau, who has pumped tens of millions of dollars through super PACs into Trump's presidential campaign, as well as into former South Carolina governor and now U.S. UN ambassador Nikki Haley's 527 committees, which Haley in 2016 used to support candidates. Bernard Marcus, the CEO of a construction company called Home Depot, which sells kind of hardware in the United States, and is the founder, is the major funder of the neoconservative group, the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, as well as a key funder to Trump. The Foundation for the Defense of Democracies has been designing sanctions on Iran, starting with the second Bush administration, and has been pushing the Saudi line in Washington. And the third figure is Paul Singer, who is a vulture capitalist who helped tank Argentina's economy and basically holds their debt, and funds a who's who of the neoconservative movement in Washington, and has also been a key funder behind Tom Cotton, the anti-Iranian senator who's become Trump's Iran whisperer and is also considered a possible next CIA director. So it's this network, these figures who are really also very close to Benjamin Netanyahu and represent kind of the funders of his cutouts in Washington, that is responsible for the Jerusalem move and the really close bond that defines Trump's policy in the Middle East, which is the Saudi-Israeli-UAE axis. And, you know, you actually can see some opposition inside the Trump administration from his National Security Council and even occasionally from his Secretary of State Rex Tillerson to this Likudnik Wahhabi network, because it's just simply gone so far that it's put the United States, it's lifted the mask off of the United States relationship with Israel and how rogue the U.S. has gone at the U.N. And really pretty much deep-sixed U.S. diplomacy in the Middle East. You know, you can say that for years the U.S. has been a rogue actor in the Middle East, but now the mask is absolutely off and it's clear the U.S. has never been an honest broker. And figures like Mahmoud Abbas, you know, the Jordanian King Abdullah, these figures are going to have to pretty much find another route to maintain any whatever legitimacy they had.
That's a very interesting explanation of the behind the scenes machinations that have gone into this seemingly out of the blue declaration recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital by Trump. Do you think these people were essentially given this as in thanks for services rendered and helping them to get elected? Is this what we're looking at? This is a vested interest, people, key figures in Trump's campaign to get elected to the White House, and this is him now parceling out favors in return?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, absolutely. And it also defines his policy towards Iran, which runs through Riyadh and Abu Dhabi. You look at Nikki Haley's absurd speech, where she brought the GCC ambassadors, including Youssef Al-Otaiba, who is the UAE ambassador, to you know, sit in the front row while she stood before the Hulk, the hulking shell of a Houthi ballistic missile, which was fired on Riyadh. You know, Haley claimed that it had been supplied by Iran, which is an issue that's well in dispute. She declared a week after Donald Trump himself called for an end to the Saudi siege on Yemen, that this missile threatened a civilian airport. She asked Americans to imagine if it had been fired at LaGuardia Airport or Dulles Airport in Washington, and, you know, ignoring all of the missiles that have rained down on Yemen, which have been supplied by the United States through the arms firm General Dynamics and the UK, where you are. And, you know, you have to look at Nikki Haley's political history. Who is Nikki Haley? She is the former governor of South Carolina. She has no international diplomatic experience whatsoever, and she was essentially selected by the neoconservatives to serve as Trump's UN ambassador to undercut Trump's proposed America First policy, which would have represented a rollback of the United States from the Middle East. During the campaign, Trump accused Saudi Arabia correctly of a role in 9/11. He condemned the U.S. invasion of Iraq.
Max, how do you account for this complete disjuncture between his campaign statements, his campaign promises, his rhetoric, what you just mentioned about Saudi Arabia and its nefarious role in international affairs, his positive statements towards the possibility of reset relations, or his intention to reset relations with Moscow, to reorient US foreign policy towards fighting international terrorism, to pull back from all these wars and military interventions? How do you account for this 180 in terms of his foreign policy?
Yeah, the Trump presidency is the story of sort of a deluded and unqualified character who's been overwhelmed by what could correctly be called a deep state, the American national security state, the permanent war state. And so, Russiagate begins out of the ashes of the Clinton campaign. Michael Flynn, who is Trump's national security advisor, falls under surveillance by the National Security Agency. He makes a phone call from a foreign location in the Cayman Islands to Sergei Kislyak, the Russian ambassador to the U.S., lies about the phone call, even though what he wound up discussing with Kislyak was perfectly legitimate, as we now know from Flynn's indictment. He's forced out of his position as Trump's national security advisor. Tom Cotton, who I mentioned before, who has been cultivated by the neoconservative movement to serve in the Senate, demands that Trump select H.R. McMaster, who is a general who participated in counterinsurgency operations in Iraq, worked under David Petraeus, as sort of the typical character of the deep state, believes in extending and expanding American ground wars. Cotton demands that Trump select McMaster as Flynn's replacement. Trump does so, and he's praised by John McCain and the neocons. Then Haley comes in as UN ambassador. Haley herself had been funded by the same neoconservative network that created Tom Cotton, Sheldon Adelson, Bernard Marcus, Paul Singer, and had been advised by Bill Kristol, the kind of guru of the neocons in Washington. And Trump becomes completely overwhelmed by this neoconservative network. Bannon is forced out, the kind of creator of the America First banner of Trump's campaign. And the next thing you know, Trump is really no longer in control of his foreign policy and no longer cares. He's caught up in the culture wars in America. And so here we are in a very dangerous situation with the U.S. seeking to intensify the war on Yemen, engaging in dangerous brinksmanship with Iran, and bonding with the really out-of-control renegade regime of Mohammed bin Salman in Riyadh.
Indeed, and clearly you mentioned the Likudite Wahhabi network. There is no doubt that Saudi Arabia, under Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman or King Salman himself, and Netanyahu in Tel Aviv, have drawn closer in recent months. And in Trump, as I think I mentioned in my introduction, they have found a match. This is a match made in heaven, because now they have someone, a placeman in the White House, who's willing to do their bidding when it comes to confrontation with Iran. And this is where we see some of the unhinged statements from Trump regarding trying to put Hezbollah in the same Salafi jihadi box as Nusra and ISIS or Daesh in recent months. I mean, it sounds to me like he's now being played. Now, is this to give him too much credit, or is this to discredit his intelligence too much? Because I think we have to be careful that we don't try and sort of give Trump an opt-out. Yes, he is clearly unqualified for this position. I don't think he's stupid, but he's certainly a man devoid of all ethics and morals. There's no doubt about that. He's enjoying the limelight. He's an egomaniac. He's clearly a sociopath. So we've got all this character, all these character traits and maladies are now in the worst possible place they can be to be given life force, and that is in the White House, as a leader of the so-called free world. After the break, Max, I'd like to get into the domestic agenda of Trump and if he sees this of being any benefit when it comes to the sort of Christian right in terms of bolstering his base at a time when his polling figures are through the floor. You're listening to Max Blumenthal. This is Hard Facts. We'll be right back.
Hard Facts.
Welcome back to Hard Facts. I'm sitting down with writer and author Max Blumenthal, and we are discussing the continuing fallout from Donald Trump's unconscionable and illegal, it has to be said, recognition of Jerusalem as a capital of Israel. Now, Max, as I said just before the break, Trump's polling numbers have gone through the floor. The liberal establishment has gone on the front foot. We have Russiagate. We have this ongoing investigation led by ex-FBI Director Robert Mueller, lapping up against his door, the door of the Oval Office, with the indictment of Michael Flynn, who has made it known that he's willing to cooperate in the ensuing investigation. He's now admitted that he lied to the FBI. But this is, as others have said, this is a nothing burger up to now, isn't it? This really is about trying to find Russians under the bed. And now even the leader of the Green Party, Jill Stein, who I consider one of the most ethical and one of the most progressive politicians in the Western world, has now been ensnared in this ongoing investigation. Give us an up-to-date analysis and an up-to-date report of where we are with this investigation, because it is connected in some way to what we're discussing with regards to the recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital.
You want to discuss Russiagate in the context of the Jerusalem
analysis? Yes, because I'm thinking this is a distraction. You see, for Trump is under huge pressure and unremitting pressure with this investigation into any connection between his campaign and Russia and the Kremlin. And so this is a way for bolstering his base. It gives him huge credit with the all-important pro-Israel lobby, the Christian right, the swivel-eyed Christian fundamentalists who can't wait for end times. And they see Jerusalem as central in that. So give us your understanding, if you would, of how this is helping Trump, or how he sees it helping him to distract from this hostile attention he's received and this negative press with regard to these ongoing investigations into Russia in connection with his campaign.
Well, first of all, you know, with regard to Trump's domestic strategy, he's playing to a strategy that the right wing of the Republican Party has engaged in ever since Nixon's Southern strategy. You saw it also with the Republican Congress under George W. Bush. It's the idea of playing to the majority of the minority, which is the majority of kind of white heartland voters, because we have an electoral system in the U.S. that isn't really democratic. Trump believes if he can hold on to the red states and then win some swing districts in states that are mixed between Democrats and Republicans, he can pull out another election. And this means going to the hard right and driving the culture war. And Jerusalem is a culture war issue for the Christian right. Trump has won extensive, deep support from evangelicals, despite being a confessed sexual harasser with really no clear religious background. And so, you know, I've seen photographs of a bus operated by a Christian evangelical organization driving around Jerusalem with a big banner on it thanking Trump for his announcement, a who's who of Christian Zionist pastors who have hundreds of thousands of followers each around the country have been effusively thanking Trump and urging their supporters to go out and back him. So this is Trump's domestic strategy, and it encourages him to take a more right-wing line on Israel than even, you know, the previous raft of pro-Israel presidents. The problem for the Democrats is you have a figure like Chuck Schumer, who is the minority leader of the Democrats in the Senate, boasting that he encouraged Trump to make the Jerusalem announcement because he's so heavily funded by AIPAC-related interests, Israel lobby-related interests. Israel and the Middle East is not a legitimate line of attack for the Democratic Party against Trump, and so they have Russia, a country with far, far less influence in the United States, negligible influence, and it's kind of a red herring or a sop to use to attack Trump with. And that's, you know, why we have the Russiagate investigation. It's why after, you know, over a year, we've turned up almost nothing of substance to demonstrate Trump-Russia collusion. The investigation's falling apart, and in many ways, it's starting to blow back on the Democrats. And Robert Mueller, the former FBI director who's in charge of the investigation. It's why you're seeing false stories being leaked to reporters. And it's why the investigation is starting to target people on the left, like Jill Stein, the former Green Party candidate, who this month received a demand from the Senate Intelligence Committee for pretty much to deliver all of the Green Party campaign documents because Jill Stein had appeared a few times on RT and gone to RT's 10th anniversary gala in Moscow in 2015, which is just absolutely absurd and exposes this whole investigation as a kind of McCarthyite scam. So basically, you know, if it wasn't for Russiagate, I think we would be talking more about the destabilizing agenda of Trump and the Saudi-Israeli axis, not just in Jerusalem, but in Yemen and across the Middle East. And I think, you know, this major story just erupted in international news, which related to a study by the Conflict Armament Research, a UK-based group, which determined conclusively that ISIS had received something like 80% of its weapons from countries that had been from arms dealers who had been delivering arms to Syria purchased by the United States. So the United States had been at least indirectly arming ISIS. This should have been a massive scandal in the United States. But instead, if you turn on any of the cable news networks, you're going to see wall-to-wall coverage of Russiagate.
It's a complete diversion. Moving on to the plight of the Palestinians, Max, I know that you have deep attachment to that struggle and their struggle. You've been there many times. Your book, 51 Day War, regarding the brutal treatment that they were subjected to in the context of 2014 Operation Protective Edge in Gaza. I've read that book. I would advise all the listeners, if they haven't, to obtain a copy. It gives you a fantastic insight and humanizes the Palestinian. This is why I purposely mentioned Ibrahim Abu Thuraya during my introduction, the man with the double amputee who was killed in his wheelchair during a recent protest against this unilateral declaration recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital. Where does this long-suffering people go from here, Max? Who is going to help this people? Because despite all the condemnation from the international community, even Britain and France, long-time allies, you know, we're talking a tiger without teeth. If there's no way to coerce Israel and the United States when it comes to upholding international law and being subjected to international law, this is just more hot air. The Palestinians need more than hot air. We're talking about BDS, but on the ground in Palestine, where do they go from here? We hear talk of a third intifada. Is that the future?
I do not actually think that we're looking at a third intifada, because something like that would be physically impossible. That's one of the reasons the separation wall was built. A third intifada would really center around Jerusalem, and it would require people from the West Bank being able to access Jerusalem. They no longer are. The Palestinian citizens of Israel can, but they are, you know, substantially under siege in a way that they weren't during the first and second intifadas. And so Jerusalem is kind of left on its own. It's sort of under, you know, the 300,000 Palestinians of Jerusalem are often cut off from each other. You have entire areas of Jerusalem that are even on the other side of the separation wall. So it's a very dismaying scenario on the ground. And I think what we are going to have to see as a first step is the dismantlement of the Palestinian Authority. That would require an acceptance that the struggle for Palestinian sovereignty or statehood alongside an Israeli state has reached its terminal end. It's time for the PA to end its coordination with the Israeli military in Area A, which are the cities in the West Bank, and to essentially declare that this is apartheid, that Israel has control over essentially everything. There needs to be reconciliation between the Palestinian factions, and the Palestinian diaspora has been cut out of the decision-making process by the PLO. The Palestinian Legislative Council should allow the diaspora to begin to elect leadership, and the process should be internationalized. The gerontocracy of the PA should come to an end, and a figure who's a compelling, charismatic, Mandela-like figure should be given the platform at the UN to speak on behalf of the Palestinian people and breathe some life into this movement. Until then, we're left with the BDS movement, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement, which represents people from international civil society, including non-Palestinians like you and I. And, you know, the burden is really on the BDS movement at this point, for as long as the Palestinian Authority, which is essentially the occupation subcontractor, exists.
BDS is coming for some unsavory attention from Netanyahu himself in speeches. Nikki Haley mentioned the BDS during her recent speech at the UN. condemning the UN resolution, which unified the UN in a way that we haven't seen in decades. BDS has now become the main locus of struggle for the Palestinian people, hasn't it, Max? I mean, this is now considered and perceived to be a strategic threat because it doesn't just operate on a material basis. It operates, perhaps even more importantly, on a moral basis, because the BDS draws comparison with the international campaign of boycott, divestment and sanctions that played such a key role in ending apartheid in South Africa. The last thing the Israeli establishment wants is to be described in the same terms as apartheid South Africa. And this is why they're doing their utmost to demonise BDS, demonise its activists, with the dread word anti-Semitism being bandied around in a very cavalier fashion. So give us your analysis of where we are, BDS. I know here in the UK it is growing in popularity over the years. It has been very effective. How effective is it in the US, Max?
Well, it's been very effective in the US as an educational campaign. It's unclear what material effects it's had on Israeli businesses, but they certainly haven't been positive. And it's forced the Israeli lobby to dedicate untold resources to combating what it considers to be a key strategic threat to the state of Israel. An Anti-Defamation League and Reut Institute study, the Reut Institute is closely connected to the Israeli government, has determined that BDS is an existential threat to Israel as an exclusive ethnocratic state. And that really speaks to the value of BDS. You know, if you think about the protesters who were going out in front of the Ahava shops in London regularly. Ahava is the Israeli cosmetics company, which sells Dead Sea mud gathered from an illegal Israeli settlement. And what those protesters were doing was not just disrupting the business of this company, which is engaged in illegal colonization. They were raising questions in the minds of passersby and generating media about what Israel is actually doing in the West Bank. And, you know, I can tell you just from my own experience getting involved in the Palestine Solidarity Movement or reporting on Palestine as a journalist, I did not take BDS seriously in 2009 when I threw myself into the issue. And now I really see it as the only game in town. It gives people something to do, but it also challenges the fantasy of liberal Zionism, that there can be a two-state solution based on U.S.-led negotiations. And what BDS is doing is demanding that Israel abide by three key pieces of international law that would effectively force Israel to observe the equality of the Palestinian people and thereby rips the mask off Israel as a democracy and reveals it as an ethnocracy, because Israel is fighting equal rights for Palestinians tooth and nail. It is simply an ethno-supremacist apartheid state. And so BDS, from an educational standpoint, is responsible for introducing so many millions of people across the West to that concept, and really just torn apart the hypocrisy of Israel as the, you know, a Jewish and democratic state, as if the United States could be a white Christian and democratic state.
Max, quickly, we're running out of time. I mentioned the extent to which activists and prominent voices such as yourself are in support of the Palestinians have been demonised and attacked. Give us an insight quickly, if you would, on to the way that you've been attacked, because I know you've come in for quite a lot of very, very hostile attention from supporters of the status quo in Israel regards the Palestinians.
Well, I released a book in 2013, Goliath, which compiled 5 years of my reporting inside Israel and occupied Palestine. And the book, you know, was aimed to paint a picture of a society under the control of a radical right wing with an indoctrinated, militarized youth who were substantially racist, a country that had basically gone off the rails. And, you know, the book was attacked viciously by liberal Zionists, by right-wing Zionists. I became one of the key targets of the pro-Israel lobby in the U.S. And was basically, as someone who's Jewish, who continues to observe Judaism, I was attacked as an anti-Semite. I think I made number 4 on the Simon Wiesenthal Center's anti-Semite blacklist in 2015. And, you know, it even became, you know, this hasn't relented, But what has happened is that my book and the narrative in the book, my perspective on Israel, has been really vindicated.
Well, listening to that, Max, I'm reminded of Irish revolutionary James Connolly's famous aphorism: apostles of freedom are ever crucified when alive, but glorified when dead. You've been listening to Max Blumenthal. I'm John White. Until next time, remember, the only facts worth taking seriously are hard facts.